The meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:03 p.m. on Wednesday, March 19th, 2025. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Mina, Representative Vance, Representative Eichheit, Representative Underwood, and myself, Representative Kopp, Vice Chair. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. As a courtesy, please silence your cell phones. I'd also like to take a moment to recognize the staff supporting this meeting, Lori Rowland, House Records. Thank you, Lori. And Susan Quigley from the Juneau LIO, the Judiciary Committee aide, Nate Graham. We have two items before us on today's agenda, House Bill 6, State Fund Fiduciary Duty, and House Bill 118, Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. House Bill 6, State Fund Fiduciary Duty, is our first item of business today by Representative McCabe. Representative McCabe, sir, if you'd please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your opening remarks.
Try to do this without falling. Good afternoon, Vice Chair Kopp and members of the House Judiciary Committee. Thanks for hearing. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, representative for House District 30. With me, I have my staff, Julie Morris, who is on the phone. I believe Julie will be available to read the section via into the record should the committee wish. And Angela Steffel, my chief of staff, is with us as well. Again, thanks for hearing HB 6. This bill keeps our Alaska Permanent Fund and State Retirement Fund doing what they're built for, doing what they already do for the most part, making money for Alaskans, not bowing to trendy mandates from across the pond or anywhere else. Here's why we need it. Pecuniary duty is our North Star. The Permanent Fund and the State Retirement Fund have one job: grow the pot to fund state government and the PFD, which was $1,702 per Alaskan last year. That's real money for real needs. Roads, schools, heat. HB 6 locks fiduciaries into pecuniary interest, maxing returns with no detours. Mr. Vice Chair, this is about keeping our funds' eyes on the prize, not chasing feel-good fluff like Europe's forcing their companies right now. Take Alex Epstein's moral case for fossil fuel. He nails it. Coal, oil, gas. That's what keeps Alaska running. That's what keeps the world running. Our funds' roots are in oil, royalties, and coal still raking it in, 8.7 billion tons globally in 2023. HB 6 says we don't dump winners such as coal, even if they don't fit the latest social environmental justice fad just for net zero hype. It's just not profit. It's what powers our homes and jobs. Over in Europe, they're rolling out rules like the corporate sustainability push, forcing companies to sink cash into DEI and ESG investing, whether it pays or not. Worse, they're pressuring those companies to ditch business with American or Alaskan firms that don't play along with them. It's a top-down order to chase alarmist fads over shareholder value. HB 6 says Alaska's not going to be playing that game. We don't let Brussels dictate our funds, divesting coal or propping up diversity quotas to appease bureaucrats, especially not in Europe. We stay free, focused on pure pecuniary returns for our funds and for Alaskans. Check the track record. ESG and DEI don't guarantee wins. In 2022, the APF beat benchmarks with energy bets while some ESG funds bled 20%, chasing green dreams. Consider Bed Bath & Beyond. In 2022, they went big on ESG. By 2023, they were bust. DEI is no silver bullet either. Companies pour time and money into it, and where's the profit? HB 6 keeps us clear of that mess. So here's a red flag. Companies in a hole, like retailers on the ropes, pivot to ESG or DEI for headlines and goodwill, hoping to attract people, attract buyers, and attract shareholders. It's a Hail Mary that usually flops. Think of chains of stores slapping sustainability or green on everything, and they're still shutting their stores. Our funds aren't lifelines for losers. HB 6 ensures we back winners, not PR stunts. Consider Norway's fund, their $1.6 trillion fund. They have no dividends, no pressure. They fund their government through taxes. That fund just grows and grows. They can afford to spend a little money on DEI, and they do. Our $80 billion fund is different. We use it for so much. We use it to fund our government. We use it for PFD. It's for Alaskans. It's not some global experiment. Europe's mandating DEI spending, and that's fine for them. HB6 says, we don't risk your money, Alaskans' money, on unproven green tech or social checklists. Coal, firearms, if they pay, they stay. That's my motto for this bill. If they pay, they stay. Some say coal is doomed. Climate rules, market shifts, and maybe someday that'll be true. But right now it's not. Right now it's king. Energy stocks carried us in 2022. Epstein's right in the moral case. Fossil fuels fix more than net zero prevents. We need to look unemotionally at the data, at the profits, and invest for that. HB6 keeps us grounded. Don't ditch winners for what-ifs. If the tide turns, we'll adjust, and we'll do it without Europe's forced DEI playbook. Vice Chair Coppin, Committee HB6 is our stand. Our fund generally already does it. This just reinforces that the legislature agrees that our fund should not invest for anything other than pecuniary interest to grow our fund for Alaskans' retirement, and for Alaskans' permanent fund. Keep in mind, this bill also talks about the retirement fund. Very, very important, especially if you're considering some sort of other retirement plan. We would want to keep the retirement fund growing and growing money, not just growing trendy DEI or ESG things. You know, a dollar earned beats a dollar flashed just for clout. This bill is a promise that we won't do that, that we will earn dollars for our funds. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill, and I'm available for any questions. And as I said, Julie Morris is available online to read the sectional if that's what you would like.
Yes, thank you, Mr. McCabe, for that introduction and overview of the bill. I think we would like to hear the sectional. So, Ms. Morris, if you're online, could you just identify yourself for the record and walk us through the sectional? Thank you.
Yes, this is Julie Morris. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Kopp and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Morris, staff to Representative Kevin McCabe. The sectional analysis for HB6 is as follows. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 3710.071 to require that fiduciaries of state funds prioritize beneficiaries' financial interests, banning the consideration of social, political, or ideological factors in investment decisions. Section 2 and 3 amends Alaska Statute 3710.220 to require that the Alaska Retirement Management Board and the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board prioritize beneficiaries' financial interests, prohibiting consideration of social, political, or ideological factors in investment decisions. That ends the sectional for HB6.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. I appreciate that. Questions from committee members. We also have Devin Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell, thank you for being here, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's Executive Director and CEO. I have a couple questions. I'm not sure if they're more appropriate to you, Mr. Mitchell, or bill sponsor, Representative McCabe. Can we provide examples of cases where Alaska's fiduciaries have prioritized an ideological goal versus just an outcome of a financial return? In other words, ideology over a financial return, either from you, Mr. McCabe, or Mr. Mitchell.
So I can start through the record. It's Representative Kevin McCabe from District 30. So I don't think the permanent fund or the retirement board in Alaska, and I haven't delved that far into their investments, but I don't believe that they have prioritized that at all.
Okay.
But I also don't believe that Mr. Mitchell and myself are going to be here forever, and I want to make sure that we tighten up the language in our statutes to make sure that it's very clear from the legislature to the permanent fund that they don't do that. So that's maybe Devin has something further, but it's not my intent to say they are doing that whatsoever. Really, my intent is say doing a good job. We just want it to be a little bit tighter and a little bit better understood.
Okay. Thank you, Representative McCabe. I don't want a follow-up question, but go ahead. Go ahead. Go jump in the queue. Representative Mina, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Through the chair, thank you, Representative McCabe, for bringing this bill forward to the committee. I'm wondering, this also might be more appropriate for Mr. Mitchell, if you could just speak to the basics of the prudent investor rule for the managers at the permanent fund. And I guess my question is just related to that, is what are the times when the legislature has governed over the prudent investor rule and the decisions that the managers make?
For the record, Devin Mitchell, CEO and Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, through the Chair, Representative Mina. The prudent investor rule simply means, in general terms, that you are going to invest the trust money, the fund's money, in a fashion that's going to maximize the risk-adjusted rate of return for the beneficiaries without personal considerations or other considerations being taken into account. The times that you've seen deviations from that have typically been divestiture efforts, and so there's some atrocity being conducted by a country that there's policy that is implemented. And most recently, we saw this being done with Russia after the initial Ukraine invasion. There was a lot of divestiture efforts around the country and world. The permanent fund in Alaska was able to avoid having that mandated divestiture because of the market of the day and all of those securities being sold. It created, in essence, a form of fire sale, a bargain sale, that you're selling your securities at a small fraction of the value that they might have had otherwise prior to the divestiture effort, or if you held them to maturity. And so we were able to hold on to those securities and sell them off or have them mature in the normal course of business, which was very beneficial. And so that dovetails into the prior question that the fund hasn't made decisions on either investments or divestitures based on anything but maximizing the risk-adjusted rate of return for the fund. And in fact, if you looked at some of the presentations that have been provided to the corporation's board over the last several years, there have been discussions of the cost of having an ESG or other priority for purposes of determining how you deploy money. And again, because it oftentimes, like tobacco was maybe the initial area that there was a divestiture effort. And so tobacco stocks diminished in market value as a result of that. And the investors that stayed in those stocks or invested in those stocks because of the nature of the products and diversification of those companies have done very well. And so it indicates like it's you're willing to pay a price for purposes of implementing a more of a policy agenda than a maximizing return agenda.
May I follow up?
Yes, Representative Mina, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Chair Kopp, just as a follow up, so then related to just knowing that the managers at the corporation do focus on maximizing profits for the corporation and for the state, in our laws, does the legislature have any authority in regulating those investment decisions?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, our allowed investments are statutorily provided for. So yes, you dictate how the permanent fund is invested in statute.
I do one more follow-up.
Yes. Yep.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Mm-hmm. Through the chair, what are the ways right now in the status quo that the legislature dictates those investment decisions?
through the chair, Representative. I mean, it's more broad, and so more on an asset class basis. So originally the permanent fund was invested entirely in fixed income securities, just the conservative nature of the state and relatively high interest rates at the time, and relatively poor performance of equities in the 1970s, the decade that had just ended at the point in time that money was really flowing into the permanent fund. And that gradually increased in subsequent years to where we had real estate and public equities added, and then private equities and absolute return or hedge funds, and then private infrastructure. So there's been a gradual evolution of allowed investments as the markets have evolved over the course of the last 50 years, and the need to have greater degrees of risk to obtain the same expected rates of return.
Thank you.
Question I have, Representative Vance, you have a question. Go ahead. Your floor is yours. Yeah.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. I don't want to disrupt your...
Okay,
your
that was a deep thought there. No, I'm going right down the rabbit trail of how this would play out. If an investment fund, decided to divest themselves from, let's say, a project that we think, that some people think is really needed, let's say we needed micronuclear power at a remote site in Alaska, but for financial risk, whatever, they said they couldn't do it, could they be caught up in any kind of a unintended consequence of this, and when their return was, their decision maybe to not invest was based on financial risk, nothing that had to do with that form of energy that they, you know, hostility to it. I'm just making sure we're not, the sword maybe sometimes can cut both ways, that we're not creating a situation where they would be barred from making a financial decision based on risk that maybe some people would look at and say, well, you're caving to whatever, but if you're a fiduciary, you're saying, no, we just financially couldn't carry this risk on this project. And it could have to do with climate change too. Maybe it had to do with a site location and that site was collapsing into the water or sinking. So you could have climate change in there too, and you're making a decision that the financial risk of the project is great, it's related to climate change, but it's not because you're carrying the water for climate change. You're just, do you understand what I'm saying?
Chair Kopp, I understand perfectly what you're saying, and that was the reason we had an indeterminate fiscal note initially, is that we read the bill just on the words in the proposed language. And we're concerned that there could be some potential along that line. What if we have a company in our portfolio that has some policy that might misalign with the intent of this legislation? I think Representative McCabe's testimony has provided a lot of comfort to myself that's not the intent of this legislation, that the intent of this legislation is to prevent our board from dictating that investment decisions be made based on these criteria, rather than prohibiting an investment that's otherwise allowed and might be successful based on some of the attributes that are listed in the legislation, that wouldn't be prohibited, that we'd still be able to deploy money, maximize return, but we're not doing so with a policy bent. We're not doing it because we believe that we're trying to change some thing from a policy perspective.
Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. So, Representative Kevin McCabe again. So, yes, absolutely, the sole focus is on fiscal on this. So, for an example, say the board changes. I'm not here, you're not here, we have a different governor and the board is a little bit different. Exxon is making huge profits, but they haul that bad oil that everybody wants to get rid of because everybody's trying to... So, I could see a possibility where they would be able, or they would be forced to divest themselves of Exxon because of what it does, not because of what it makes or doesn't make. So the focus here is to make sure that we are able to invest in companies that are making money. regardless of the social or net zero or anything like that. So that's the focus of this. It just tightens it up a little bit, and it's not a critique of what the permanent fund's doing right now at all. It's just for our children and our grandchildren. I had to bring children in, right? So, but it's for the future. For going forward, we want to have a nice, tight saying, please, we only want you to invest in things that are going to grow the fund and for what I call pecuniary interests. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative McCabe. I think that's important to establish that in the legislative record. Mr. Mitchell, you've served the state for a long time, and we appreciate your service. So I'm going to tap your memory bank a little bit here. I think Alaska has very strict procurement laws on where we can invest and how we can contract, especially when it comes to any third party, but I may be thinking of countries that are on a list that is established by the State Department as being people that, for some of these are political and social reasons, they're hostile to the United States interest. Am I remembering that correctly, that we have a list that every state procurement officer has, and if we are sourcing from a country that's on this list, that this we get a refresh from the State Department every year that they're a no-go. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's maybe taxing my memory too much. I do recall like Sudan and Somalia and like a list of countries where there were concerns about the potential of the U.S.-based investors deploying money to a regime that was hostile to the United States. Right. And that there was I have vague memories of that there was de minimis to no investment in those countries in the first place, and I can't remember the specific outcome of that. If there's, I haven't heard of an annual diligence requirement that we report on.
Okay.
That an affirmation that we don't have an investment in a certain list of countries, but I could just not be aware of that. So I could get back to you and let you know. But the general concept has definitely circulated and been something that has impacted the fund and the retirement funds in the past.
Yeah. Thank you for that answer. I think it's under the Department of Administration regulations for procurement and contracts. There is a federal list that the state is precluded from contracting with. And some of them are because of their egregious child labor, child mining, sex trafficking, or all kinds of things that if you're on the bad list for the U.S. government, we don't. And inadvertently, those can be environmental, social, governance, things that we determine are in our interest. And I almost in humor would say I very much support the bill sponsor's attempt, but he and I think alike on a lot of this. But I want to make sure inadvertently we're not prohibiting ourselves from divesting ourselves from investing in entities, foreign governments, for the same reasons, because we just fundamentally disagree. Their values fly against our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and protection of what we see as the good of the human race. And so I just want to be careful. Like I said, sometimes the sword can cut both ways, that we're not doing that. But I greatly appreciate the bill sponsor's intent. The environmental social governance regulations can absolutely bring any good project to a complete stop. And I think that's what – go ahead, sir.
So thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. So the intent of this bill, we had this discussion last year as well. So somebody said, I brought up the Exxon discussion, and somebody said, well, Exxon has a DEI program. Mm-hmm. Should we not invest in Exxon because they have a DEI program? And my answer was, are they making money? Right? I mean, nothing in this bill is intended to usurp federal law, or if the federal government says thou shalt not invest in somewhere because of blood diamonds or whatever, as you said. Absolutely understand that, and I don't think anybody, I certainly wouldn't complain. But I want to make sure that, as I said, that we are investing for financial gain for our funds.
Right.
Not for, there are other companies out there that their sole focus is DEI and ESG and we don't need to invest in them just for their ESG thing. If they're making a profit, if they're a profitable company, I'm all for it, right?
Yes.
But if they're not a profitable company and they're only out there, in fact, many companies will, as I said, I used a kind of a close to home example, but many companies, as they are failing, even many funds as they are failing, they start to embrace this ESG thing, hoping to buoy themselves up, you know, ESG and DEI, hey, look at us. Mm. And they ended up failing anyways, because Americans clearly have said, we're not into that. In fact, I've been invited several times to the State Financial Officers Federation and talked to them about this, and they are 100% on board with this, right, this bill from last year. So, in fact, I think I got invited because I wrote the bill last year. So.
All right. Thank you, Representative McCabe. Committee members. Representative Vance.
Thank you.
Yes.
On this topic, we've seen globally and across the nation that the ESG policies and also boycotting oil and gas by large investment firms, people who have a lot of holdings and a lot of control. We've seen, these companies use proxy votes on some important boards to play a switcheroo and change the direction. I was wondering, Mr. Mitchell, how have some of these policies impacted the growth of the permanent fund over these past number of years of a lot of change? I mean, it feels like we were the target of a lot of these companies because we are known as an oil and gas company. But the fund obviously is diverse. How do you feel like there's been missed opportunities because of these policies with the investments? You know, is that something that you feel like you're having to dodge landmines as you're looking at different investments and ways to grow the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't think it's been an issue for the fund. The Alaska Permanent Fund is a well-respected member of the investment community on a both nationwide as well as worldwide basis. And so as a partner that is able to put money to work for long periods of time, that's sought after by the investment community. To the extent that the basis of the permanent fund, the $20 billion of seed money from oil revenues that created the permanent fund over the years, hasn't been an issue that I've had to deal with at all. So I don't believe that there's any lost opportunity as a result of the origination of the funding of the permanent fund or the fact that Alaska is a resource state and the permanent fund's a resource of the state of Alaska. If anything, where you it goes back to the tobacco thing and then various other initiatives that you might see, a contemporary of maybe more the ARM board, the retirement funds, but CalPERS, for example, where they do actively pursue ESG and DEI policy in their investment decisions process. And so that results in you're paying a price. You're buying something that it's not just based on a financial analysis. It's based on both a financial analysis to some extent, but then a policy and a desire to change something. And so they're paying a price as a result of that. And so if anything, we've benefited from our more independent stance historically.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Thank you for that. Earlier you mentioned being able to avoid the divestiture regarding Russia. I was a part of those conversations in House State Affairs Committee a few years ago, and it was a real tumultuous conversation. And I'm trying to remember what the fund was estimating the loss would be, and it was hard to know at that time. The Russian markets were frozen, but it was definitely going to be a loss. Do you have a number on total ballpark, what we avoided losing if we had divested during that fire sale? I'm remembering a very minimum number was $250 million just out of the gate, just just to start that process. And I know I'm putting you on the spot from a few years ago, but the reason I bring it up is I think this highlights the concern that, suddenly you were going to have a fire sale on what was a hot topic at the moment, and things, the market changed and things changed quickly. Can you just update this committee on kind of that process that the corporation was having to look at the time, because the legislature was strongly considering divestiture?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but if there were 1% of the fund invested in Russia at the time, and that maybe that's a high number, maybe it would only be 0.5% just based on again, just the economy that exists in Russia and the relationships historically between the United States and Russia. So, many of those securities lost almost all of their value for a period of time. I mean, you could have sold a dollar at a penny. And it wasn't that you weren't going to, on a bond, for example, that you weren't going to be able to recoup that. There were still interest payments being made on the bonds. It was just there was no secondary market. There were no buyers. And so, if anything, it was probably an opportunity to lean in if you actually believed that Russia was going to pay on those securities and it otherwise fit your risk tolerance for the asset class, whether it was global bonds or some kind of equity stake that we might have had in a company, that might have been a time instead of pulling away, you would have leaned in. But at the same time, there was a lot of outrage about the from the international community about the invasion of Ukraine. And so I think that Alaska was able to to hit the sweet spot, if you will, where there weren't additional deployments in Russia, but we didn't have a fire sale. We were able to hold those securities and exit in a rational fashion. And so you saw that the losses we otherwise would have incurred were not. And but I could gladly, I'd be glad to get back to you with what the numbers were at the time.
In response?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. No, thank you for that. I think it highlights kind of the point of this bill that Representative McCabe is talking to, is that we want you to make sound financial decisions. And just in the past few years, it feels like it's hard to keep up with the different social and political ideas and policies that would distract your focus from the financial aspect of trying to keep up with figuring out what the legislature's will is for these investments. And that it feels like the fund has just respected the traditional will of the legislature. Is that to be able to stay focused just on finances, is that a safe assumption that we haven't jumped off that deep end, and it's been kind of traditional? Is that
through the chair, Representative Vance, there's really two prongs to that. So there's the constitutional framework around the permanent fund. It's a fairly simple amendment, three kind of components. The middle is that the money's going to be invested in income-producing securities. And so that kind of lays a framework for you're doing this to make money. That's mm-hmm. constitutional. And then there's a statutory framework built around that with the concepts of prudent investor rule and fiduciary, as well as maximizing risk-adjusted rate of return. So that framework is all there and created in the constitutional language as well as the statutory language that has been amended from time to time to add these additional asset classes to the portfolio of the fund.
Great. One last question, Mr. Chairman. Just in looking at what happened in Texas with proxy votes, mm-hmm. Does the Permanent Fund Board have proxy votes? And if so, who makes those votes?
Through the chair.
She's going far afield of the bill. May have to rein this line of questioning in.
Well, it's somewhat related. I mean, in as much as proxy votes are a way that with public equity securities, there are decisions from time to time that the investors are – stockholders are asked to vote on, and those could be of a nature that fall into this this territory of being for purposes that might not be strictly financial. So the corporation holds equities both directly as well as through funds, and our practice has been to have this board-aligned vote through a service, a proxy voting service. We've more recently been exploring the ability to audit how those votes have occurred to ensure that they're that they are in fact being made based on what's in the best financial interest of the fund, and anticipate having a consultant on board for that in the next couple of months, and so should be reporting something in May on where we are with that at our next board meeting, but most likely it might not be results until September when we have the results of those that additional work. But we're well aware of the need to ensure to people, to policy folks, how proxies are being voted to ensure that we're in line with our leadership.
Yeah. Thank you. That warms my heart a bit.
Thank you, Representative Vance, for the questions. I did note in the bill, reading through it here again, that one of my questions was answered, that the bill does allow as an exception following applicable federal or state law. So to my point about making investments in other entities based on our concerns towards them, we are protected there. And we can continue our investment policies as we have been. I don't have any further questions for the bills, but Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Through the chair, I'm looking at the statute related to those investment responsibilities, so AS 3713120, and from my understanding, this is in direct reference to that prudent investor rule. The responsibility for investors is to maximize the expected total return. And so going into this bill where it talks about social, political, and other factors, do investors ever consider social and political factors in their decisions?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, do they ever? I mean, certainly, like, if there were, if you were going to invest in a company that was building windmill turbines, you're probably, and those turbines are purchased based on a government support, you would, as part of your diligence process, you're gonna learn everything you can about a potential deployment of money, and this is probably more in the private market space than the public market space that you're gonna do this level of diligence on a single acquisition. But so it could be part of the process, but it's not the basis of making a deployment decision. It would rather be the total analysis of how do we expect this company's revenues to develop and support the operations and investors, and that could involve, like I said, some aspect of analyzing policies like this.
Follow up,
yes, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Through the chair. So sometimes investors do gather more political and social context related to different investment decisions. Is there ever a scenario where they're prioritizing social and political factors over their statutory responsibility to maximize the expected return of their investments?
Through the chair, no.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Through the chair to Representative McCabe, what issue are we solving with this bill?
Thanks, through the chair, Representative Mina. So there are stories of other funds who have had big funds, huge funds, whose fund manager or CEO has suddenly decided that he wants all of his investors to start investing for ESG purposes, right? So he has said, and this is a story that I read. I'm not going to name the fund or anything, but he directed all of his investors to start investing for ESG purposes only. So you don't invest in a company that doesn't. And look at Europe's new law, what, a couple months ago? I don't remember what it's the – I mentioned it in the book, but Europe has a law that says you have to consider DEI, and mostly DEI, but ESG values of a company before you can invest in them. So if you have a fund manager that decides that this is what he wants to do and he starts directing his investors that way, it can cost the fund money. And it has – I mean, there are track records of funds doing that, and so that was sort of the impetus of this, and that's what it's trying to solve. Really doesn't solve a current problem, Representative Mina. It just predicts that we could see this problem. And I mentioned the Exxon, you know, and hauling crude oil or a coal mine in Alaska where they say, well, coal is a bad four-letter word. We're not going to support any coal anymore because it pollutes the air. So they can say, well, the overarching benefit or the overarching profit is that we have cleaner air, and they can go down that rabbit trail. My idea is the overarching profit should be money only for our retirees and for our permanent fund. So
thank you for the questions. One more.
Thank you, Chair Kopp, for your indulgence. So through the chair, if then there was a manager at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation who did decide we're only going to do DEI investments, wouldn't they still be violating the prudent investor rule in AS 3713-120? Like, isn't that already what is the law to maximize the funds over any other considerations?
So through the chair, yes, that's already the law. But as I said, you can go down that rabbit trail and say, well, wait a minute, the actual profit, we're not going to see it in money, but our children will see it in clean air or that sort of thing. So you can continue down that rabbit trail if you want. And my idea is, and it's never going to happen at the permanent fund. We have a tight board. We, the legislature watches them, but there are other big funds that it has happened to because they only had one sort of overlord, if you will, that directed his investors to do that. So my idea is we just want, and this really has almost zero effect on what the permanent fund is doing right now today. All it says is pecuniary interest only, financial benefit only. So to the chairman's idea about the nuclear power plant, if it makes financial sense and makes financial money, then we should be investing in it, right? If it's going to fall through the tundra, then probably not investing in it, right? I mean, it's sort of a binary choice: money, no money, and ESG has sort of been proven to not be money. So,
and with that, Representative McCabe, I want to say thank you, sir, for bringing this important policy discussion forward, and your loyal staff, who's not here, Ms. Morris, thank you for helping, and Mr. Mitchell, thank you so much for being here and explaining the elements of the bill. The committee will now set aside HB6 and bring it up at a later date for public testimony and further consideration. Our next item of business is House Bill 118, Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, by Representative Vance and Representative Underwood. Thank you both for joining us today. Representative Vance, thank you for coming forward and putting yourself on the record and your teammate there, both of you. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Kopp and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Vance of House District 6, and this is my policy advisor, Bob Ballinger.
Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's staff.
House Bill 118 proposes to establish the Alaska Council on Human and Sex Trafficking permanently through state statute. Originally formed in December 2021 by Administrative Order 328, the council is crucial in addressing human trafficking and exploitation in Alaska. Formalizing the council in statute reaffirms our state's commitment to addressing the complex challenges posed by human trafficking. Human traffickers use force, fraud, and coercion to trap victims into servitude and commercial sexual exploitation. Victims, often deceived by promises of legitimate jobs, safe housing, and a better life, are instead exploited. Human trafficking generates roughly $100 billion annually worldwide and has surpassed the illegal small arms trade. For some Alaska-specific numbers, there was a 2017 study through Covenant Houses across the nation. 45% of trafficked youth identified were Alaska Native in that study in Anchorage. One in four homeless women at the Anchorage Covenant House had been trafficked for sex. To put it into perspective of the larger issue that intertwines with this, Alaska's rate of rape and sexual assault is three times the national average. That means if we were to cut that number in half, we would still be number one. 100% of the trafficked clients at Priceless Alaska, which is the only nonprofit organization who provides services to victims of human trafficking, report a history of sexual abuse as a child. I feel like that one needs to be said again. 100% of the trafficked clients at Priceless here in the state of Alaska report a history of sexual abuse as a child. What I didn't include on this slide is that 80% of those trafficked in Alaska have been through OCS, have been through our foster care system. Nationwide, that number is about 60%, but in Alaska, we are 20% higher in those numbers. The Alaska Institute for Justice that we previously heard from in this committee worked with more than 79 survivors in 2024, including both labor and sex trafficking. Labor trafficking is prevalent here in Alaska. We're starting to see the numbers on that that is provided by the Alaska Institute for Justice. It does happen, but one of the top issues is the sex trafficking side that we see in every community in Alaska. I could go on and on about more details about that, but I do want to bring it down to one story. Because there's a lot of assumptions about human trafficking in Alaska that it's only a rural issue or it's only an Alaska Native issue. However, I do want to highlight that there is human trafficking in every high school in Anchorage. There is trafficking prevalent in my communities on the Kenai Peninsula. And so there's a Priceless Alaska tells a story that they received communication through a variety of means of people reaching out asking for help, and they received a text message from a parent and said that their 14-year-old had been playing the game Animal Jam. I don't know, those of you who are parents, if you are familiar with this game, my children like to play different games, and Animal Jam is a very sweet, innocent, childlike game. This 14-year-old in Soldotna was playing Animal Jam and had a friend who loved to play this game together. And over time, they built up a relationship, chatting away as they played this game. The relationship, the friendship got tighter and tighter, and the friend said to this 14-year-old girl, "Hey, we love playing this game up here. Why don't we go over to this other platform and play this other game that I think you'll like?" Okay. Over the development of this relationship, picture the individual, this so-called friend, started asking for photos, and they got more and more risque. To make a long story short, this 14-year-old girl in Soldotna ended up going to a hotel, rendering services, depositing the money, and never met her trafficker. These stories are very real in Alaska. And trafficking comes in a variety of forms. It's not just the snatch and grab that you hear about or see on TV. It's not traditional kidnapping. Most of this exploitation happens online, but it is happening to the vulnerable among us. Human trafficking does not discriminate. The victims and traffickers come from all races, nationalities, ages, genders, socioeconomic backgrounds, and communities. But like I said, one of the heart-wrenching things is that 45% of the youth identified are Alaska Native, highlighting the urgency of addressing this issue. More than a decade ago, Governor Sean Parnell created Alaska's Task Force on Human Trafficking, Promoting Prostitution and Sex Trafficking. This task force, in collaboration with the Cook Inlet Tribal Council and the NGO Working Group on Sex Trafficking, laid the foundation for today's efforts. In 2013, the task force's primary recommendation was to establish a permanent working group. However, it was not acted upon until Governor Dunleavy reestablished the council in 2021. The Alaska Council, the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, continues the vital work by raising public awareness on trafficking, conducting comprehensive research, and generating reports to inform policy and strategic decisions. The Council's most recent report has been provided to the committee as a supporting document. The Council also proactively advocates for solutions and protective measures for victims. Their September 2022 report explicitly recommended establishing the Council permanently in state statute, a recommendation fulfilled by House Bill 118. The Council will provide planning and coordination of programs including victim services, public education and awareness, standardized data collection and annual reporting, awarding and auditing grants, and initiatives to reduce the demand for trafficking. I'd like to note that a lot of work has been done in DPS and through the Council on creating e-learning modules for medical professionals, teachers, law enforcement, just to know the signs of human trafficking, how to identify it, and what to do when they come across situations that seem a little off, because we do have a high rate of domestic violence, but it takes on a different flavor when it is involved with exploitation. So I just really want to commend DPS. That's something that they've been working on. They've been trying to add continuing education credits in this, and I really appreciate the efforts because it's something that you don't hear about and talk about, but they've done a lot of work with partners, federal partners, tribal partners, and other NGOs across the state to be able to gather this data to show the trends and really the impact that human trafficking and exploitation is making on the state. So if you look across the nation, there are 23 states who've adopted permanent councils. Many have been through executive order, and as you know, in an executive order, it can easily be revoked and not adopted and carried through by the next administration. However, nearly half of the nation has said this is important enough to continue in law and making it permanent so that the work can continue. There are many other grant opportunities. I'm getting ahead of myself here. There is the United States Advisory Council on Human Trafficking under the federal government, and they created the Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act in 2015, composed entirely of trafficking survivors appointed by the president for two-year terms, and advises the president's interagency task force to monitor and combat trafficking in persons. Through that, they've highlighted the need for grant opportunities, and there is up to $1 million available per state under this grant award. And in 2024, Alaska received the STOP grant award of about $156,000 to continue work with victim services, coordination, data collection, and training. The legislature aims for a seamless and costless, cost-effective transition from the existing council structure under the Governor's Council to a permanent statutory body, retaining much of its current membership and organization. The inclusion of its own executive director addresses concerns raised previously. So the Alaska Council on Human Sex Trafficking would be a 15-member council, mirroring the Administrative Order 328. 7 members appointed by the governor, 6 commissioners and the attorney general or their representative, and public members who can give a boots on the ground perspective. In conclusion, I just want to highlight that placing the Alaska Council on Human and Sex Trafficking in statute demonstrates a lasting commitment to combat human trafficking in Alaska. This stability will enhance coordination, resource allocation, and strategic effectiveness, affirming Alaska's dedication to protect the rights and safety of its residents. I welcome any questions, And I would like to highlight that we do have available to answer questions online from the Department of Public Safety's Susie Frenzel, the director, and Katie Tipas, the program coordinator. And I would like to mention that Ms. Tipas has been a part of this work for quite some time, and I just really like to highlight what a rock star she is in this effort in being consistent and persistent to be able to help support victims and really provide training to law enforcement and so many others. And she is a wealth of knowledge on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Is it Mr. Ballinger? Ballinger?
Yes, Mr. Ballinger.
Yes, sir. Could you walk us through the sectional now?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. If you go to either the bill or the sectional, the bill may be helpful. If you go to Section 1, this just exempts the executive director as not part of classified services. Section 2 adds the council to a list of commissions or boards. Then Section 3 is sort of the meat of the bill. So Section 3, starting in 44-41-150, is the purpose of the council. And Representative Vance sort of hit on this when she went in. But if you look, starting in the third line, on line 13, it says the purpose of the council is to provide planning and coordination of program-specific victim services, education, public awareness, data collection, and dissemination. So getting the data out. And then it also may create, reducing the demand on human sex trafficking. So that's the idea, is to try to get the information out and hopefully reduce demand. Under 44-41-150, you have a list of the duties. And I can go through each of them, but essentially it's to develop the board, to standardize data collection. So basically try to come up with what information that would be helpful for directing policy and for making changes. To receive and dispense money, there's federal money that is set up and designed to go to organizations that are designed like this to facilitate addressing trafficking. Oversee and audit the actual grants that go out. Coordinate and consult with the Department of Education and all the other departments. Many of them will serve on the council. Provide technical assistance to state agencies, the legislature, giving them some expertise on this issue. Conduct public hearings. Provide an annual report. So one of your supporting documents is the last annual report that was done last year that provides some data and is great for policymaking purposes. And then also to hire the executive director. Then if you look in section 44-41-160, it lists the membership. Representative Vance kind of went over that, but it lists who the members are. Two of them will be mayors. One will be from a victim advocacy organization. One will be from an Alaska Native organization. One will be from a law enforcement agency. One from a faith-based community that provides services. One from a service provider to services of the homeless. And then if you look, you see, the chief executive from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and then commissioner of health, the AG or the commissioner of health representative, AG or representative, commissioner of public safety or representative, commissioner of education or representative, commissioner of labor or representative, and a commissioner of family and community services or representative. Then if you look at in section 41, 160, the statute is still in Section 3. It lists how the meetings will be conducted. We try to make this as cost-effective as possible. So the meetings are designed to be conducted remotely, except for they can call one annual meeting. It allows for that, but doesn't require that. They are not compensated. So if you look in 44, 41, 170, there'll be no compensation, but they will be able to get travel reimbursements like other boards. And then the next just has the definition section. And then if you go down to section 4, it sets the sunset date as June 30th, 2029, like other boards and commissions. And then this, importantly, in section 5, it sets this act not to go into effect until July 1st of 2026, which will get it out of this fiscal year, which currently the under the executive order, the commission is able to continue, or the council is able to continue. This will just make it permanent before the end of this administration's term and hopefully have it permanent in statute before that. And I'm happy to answer any questions regarding the sexual.
Thank you so much, Mr. Belanger. Is it Bellinger or Belanger?
Ballinger.
Ballinger.
I'll answer to anything, Mr. Chair. Yeah,
we appreciate you walking us through that. I want to now turn to the committee. Representative Underwood, I defer to you first. Statements or questions. Thank you for co-sponsoring. Yes.
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. This is something that I'm extremely passionate about. It's kind of actually one of the things that spearheaded my journey to where I am today. It was about 5 years ago. I had helped spearhead some trafficking awareness courses and classes and community gatherings in the MATSU, and we went all the way from the MATSU to the Kenai down to Homer, where I actually initially met Representative Vance for the first time during those. And it was extremely, I don't know if enlightening is the correct word that you want to use, but mind-blowing at how much of this is going on in our backyards, especially starting out in the MATSU. I just started talking to places, organizations such as My House, which is for homeless youth, and the stories that came out of how much trafficking is going on in my own backyard, it was insane. Just to hear, like you saw today in the presentation, that Alaska is number one in this, and when you cut our numbers in half, we're number two. And the awareness classes alone, just getting the word out to people is life-changing. There was a story that came out of it that one gentleman heard the training and saw some strange behavior in Anchorage at one of the cars' Safeway parking lots and saw something, so he said something and made a phone call, and they rescued a 9-year-old little girl out of the back of a van that gentlemen were frequenting in and out of that van. And so those awareness classes do save lives. The fact that we're number one, and you saw over half the states in the country have elevated this to be a permanent solution because we are the number one state where this is actually happening. It's so important that we establish this. Being number one, we don't want to be number one more. My heart and my vision with this is that we become the very last state where this is actually happening. So I'm very honored to co-sponsor this and hope to see it get eradicated out of our state for the safety of our children, our women, even men that have experienced some of this in the realms of trafficking. It comes in so many different forms and fashions that this is a very, very important topic. So I just want to thank Representative Vance, who has been spearheading this in the legislature for quite a while. I'm proud to be a co-sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Underwood. Any other committee member questions? Representative Costello.
Thank you. I do also want to thank Representative Vance and Representative Underwood for your passion and vision in this issue. I know it really means a lot to you, and I appreciate you seeing this through so that it becomes permanent. And I really think it's important. I do have a couple questions. You mentioned there were some individuals online. One was the director that you said from DPS. Is that who was online?
Susie Frenzel, Susie? Director of Department of Public Safety.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm. And there was one other individual?
KDT POS Program Coordinator.
Thank you. So I think my question is for them, and I was hoping that they could talk about some of the work that has been done previously regarding this issue so that I can understand more, you know, what we're going to be seeing if this becomes law.
Thank you, Representative Costello. Ms. Frenzel or Ms. Tipas, if you heard the question, feel free to jump in there.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. This is Katie Tipas, T-E-P-A-S, Program Coordinator with Public Safety. Representative Costello, through the chair, to give you a little bit of background of work that's been done. As Representative Vance mentioned, Governor Parnell had a task force back in 2023, and they did lay the foundation. That task force timed out once their report was submitted to the legislative body. So then fast forward to 2021, and Governor Dunleavy issued his first of two administrative orders, which designated the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking under DPS. So the council has put forward two separate reports. One was the first report, and within that, They had significant recommendations under key priority areas. And then there is a second report that took those recommendations and I'll say fine-tune them or synthesize them down a little bit to things that we felt like we could, and I want to use this term very specifically, potentially work on without any designated funds, because with both of the administrative orders, there were not any designated funds. And so those priority areas range from expanding services to survivors to doing demand reduction programs. Those would be for the persons who are buying the sex, to addressing housing issues, to developing resource guides, training, as Representative Vance mentioned, specific to both law enforcement, medical providers, those, I guess I would say, first responders, public awareness campaign materials. Also within that was translating those materials into different languages, e-learning modules for educators and curriculum review, and then, of course, probably the biggest one was the recommendation to establish this within statute so that it would be permanent. I'll pause there.
Thank you, Ms. Tipas. Representative Costello.
Thank you. So the work is pretty significant, and it sounds like this, so there were no designated funds focused on this effort, and I'm curious then, so there probably should be then no change with putting it into statute. Is that my understanding? Is it correct?
Representative Costello, through the chair, this is Katie Tipas for the record. I'm not certain I understand your question. Could you please repeat it?
So the work that was done before was, you had mentioned there were no designated funds that went towards this effort, and so I'm curious if that would continue just by putting this into statute.
Okay. Representative Costello, through the chair, by simply putting this in statute, we probably would not be able to drastically further the mission of this particular topic or on behalf of these particular victims and survivors. We most certainly would need either grant dollars or state dollars to advance most of these components, other than, of course, council body meeting and discussing the issues from kind of a policy level. But in order to affect change or move the needle, move the dial, turn the ship, any of those phrases that you want to use, we would need additional staff. And so you would have, for example, the executive director is in there. And then as you also see in the bill, there is the ability of the executive director to hire staff. And so if grant funds are applied for, you would need to have somebody who would administer those funds as well as monitor those grants. So you'd have a program coordinator, a grant administrator as well. And then, of course, depending upon the volume of that work, we're also looking at needing some type of administrative assistant. And then another thing to consider would be some type of needs assessment or evaluation. The group, the council itself had several different subcommittees over the span of its time. And by its time, I'm referencing that 2021 to 2024 timeframe. And one of those subcommittees was our data subcommittee. We did pull together a lot of data, but that data uses a variety of different definitions, and we most certainly don't know all of the services that are available to victims and survivors of trafficking across the state, so we would need to really do a deep dive to see what was needed, not just statewide, but then you start to drill down and get to specific regions and then more localized areas. And so services can vary from mental health services to housing services to additional law enforcement, and of course that public awareness that's so often talked about. And I just want to make one point on the public awareness is I think that has really several different components to it. One is making the public aware so they can report something if they see something. But it is also making victims and survivors aware what services are available or at a very basic level that what's happening to them is criminal behavior. So this is a population with extreme underreporting. I'll pause there.
Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question for the bill sponsor.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Representative Vance, I'm just looking through the members of the Governor's Council, and it's a pretty amazing group of people. And I especially like the fact that you have mayors that are on here, and you've continued that in your legislation. It looks to me like many of the members, or the majority of the members who are on the council, are already in organizations that are working on sex trafficking currently. And so could you comment on what your vision is as this moves forward? Would these entities then take some of the responsibility for some of the tasks or goals or outcomes that you're trying to achieve financially?
Representative Costello, through the chair, this is Representative Sarah Vance. Thank you for that observation. I cannot take credit for coming up with this membership. This membership mirrors the executive order by Governor Dunleavy, minus the two legislative seats. So this is really drawing from the people who are the boots on the ground. They're doing the work in the field. They have a vested interest. Many of them are already doing a lot of the work. Mm-hmm. But it's something that we need the council to be able to pool all of the information and the work and the data and coordinate that and be able to have that response. Because right now there's a lot of different silos mm-hmm. of data and information. And by bringing it together, we're able to see trends. Right now, there's only been two reports made. And if we continue this work, we'll get to see, hey, what's the real picture that's going mm-hmm. on? Without the council, we don't have that. So I want to step back and highlight the question that you had previously for Ms. Tipas about the cost, and she mentioned grants. Right now, the Governor's Council does not have the authority to distribute and administer grants. By putting it in statute, then it can do that. Just like we have CDVSA, they can get federal grants and then put those out to different service providers to be able to help that. We are limited with the current Governor's Council on Human Sex Trafficking. And this would empower them, by being in statute, to be able to go pursue grants and really help provide services. We have one organization that is Priceless Alaska that works directly with the victims of human trafficking to help them become survivors. They were created, I believe, 17 years ago mm-hmm. under the FBI came to Gwen Adams and said, hey, we have this huge, one of the largest human trafficking busts in the nation, and they had numerous women that they needed basics like clothing, you know, just basic supplies and someplace for them to go. And that's how that organization was started. They need help. And what I'm hoping, what my vision is that over time, this council will mature in its mission and what it can do across the state, because most people are unaware that we have trafficking. A lot of our law enforcement, our teachers, our first responders are unaware of how to identify it and to distinguish the differences. So the membership that's here have been doing incredible work already. I sat the last 2 years as a legislative member on this council, and I tell you what, it's humbling to be with these giants who are it's a voluntary time that they are experts in their field, have been doing this work. But there's so much more work to be done. It feels very slow because they are having to take away from their other duties to give to this time. So having a director and admin support would be able to provide a focus on this issue to really, really maximize the potential. Thank you.
Representative Cassell, okay. Question. Previous legislature, I believe, there was a bill that would combine the domestic violence sexual assault council with the human sex trafficking council. And you could certainly make an argument for consolidation of resources. Clearly, there is a divergent mission, not the same thing, but also a lot of similarities too in rescuing priceless victims from violence. Is there any thought to consideration of that effort, just because of the simply the cost in standing up a new council with new staffing, and versus maybe giving additional resources to DVSA to take on this?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Let me give a little bit of perspective. You are right. There are two renditions of this idea. And the first one that I'm aware of came in the governor's crime bill on human and sex trafficking. And it was Senator Keel who put human trafficking under the responsibilities of CDVSA. And in the previous term, when I was working on that crime bill, I went to Senator Keel and said, what was your idea with this? He said, I just want someone to do the work. It was just a placeholder at the time. So I had this bill last year as a separate bill, and by the will of the governor's council, they decided that in order to streamline cost, that this council could share an executive director with CDVSA. They're kind of sisters on their mission, but they're not the same. And that was the recommendation, and so my bill carried that idea. However, that faced a lot of opposition, and this bill got stalled out in House Finance Committee, mainly on that issue that CDVSA has an incredible mandate, a lot of work that they're doing. And they were getting a new director at the time, and the thought was that this by putting a whole new mission in and a whole separate council, having two would be overwhelming responsibility, and we didn't want to dilute or be in competition with the mission that CDVSA has and has been doing for quite some time. And so this year, the change in the bill is for the Trafficking Council to have its own executive director and be able to grow over time. I wanted to make sure that I did not front-load the responsibilities of this council like what we see in CDVSA. They have a lot of statutory mandates that is a lot of work. What my idea with this council is to continue the work that the governor's council is currently doing and grow over time as resources become available, as we learn more about the issue and really understand the scope of the problem across the state. So I hope that little bit of history and the change that you see in this legislation helps give a little bit of perspective.
Yes, thank you, Representative Vance. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Through the chair, I think this question is for Ms. T-Pass online. I'm just looking at the current council's website online and looked through some of the supporting documents, and I didn't see it easily, so I'm just curious, how many meetings has the full council had in 2024?
Representative Eichheit, Katie Tipas, for the record. I would have to go back and check in terms of we often keep our documents by fiscal year versus calendar year. So we had, in calendar year of 24, we did have several meetings. But I'd have to go back and double check the record on that. In addition to the full council meetings, as I previously stated, we have had numerous different working groups. And often those working groups might be meeting, for example, monthly versus where the council was at the end meeting quarterly. Originally, when the council was first stood up, they were meeting monthly, but then it did shift to quarterly. So I have to go back and double check those. But I do believe the current bill is for the council to meet quarterly, and I do think that that is a fine amount of time for that.
Follow up.
Yes,
just a request, if you could get that information for the fiscal year 24 for the full council, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Vance, for putting this bill forward. On the discussion of the membership of the council, do you or any individuals on the line know the background of how the membership of the council was decided?
Through the chair, this is Representative Sarah Vance. I believe Ms. Tipas would be the best to answer that question.
Representative Mina, through the chair, could you please repeat that question?
Yes, through the chair. So my question is, for the current membership of the council, what is the history and background of how the membership structure was decided?
Okay. Representative Mina, through the chair, Katie Tipas, for the record. The membership was determined through the governor's office.
Follow up?
Yes.
Through the chair, and this might be for the bill sponsor. Now that the council has existed for a few years, this committee, we've heard presentations from Alaskans Institute for Justice, and their data is also in this report, just related to different immigrants and refugees who have been victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking. So I'm curious if we're replicating the membership that we currently have in the AO, I'm trying to think about what gaps are we missing in terms of representation of all the different sides of human trafficking. And I'm wondering if you had considered any of those gaps as it relates to immigrants and refugees, and those statistics are pretty high. I think in the data for AIJ within the trafficking data summary report, they stated that 58.76% of the clients that they serve were limited English proficient. So that's certainly an area that we want to make sure that we educate individuals who are victims. In Covenant House and then My House, they also have data from, you know, between 15 to 40% of the clients that they serve are LGBTQ. But then I'm also thinking about human trafficking, because labor trafficking is a significant issue. I know there's representation from the Department of Labor, but not from chambers and other business organizations as well. So I'm just wondering if there is any consideration of just the current membership and ways to perhaps update it and make it more representative of all the different facets of trafficking in our state.
Thank you, through the chair. This is Representative Sarah Vance. Representative Mina, you jogged my memory on this exact question the council asked of itself, going, oh my goodness, we've seen some changes, the more information that we've received, we do need to expand the membership. And that request was made to the governor's office. He did amend the EO, and a Department of Labor and Workforce Development was added, and the Commission on Family and Community Services was added. And Ms. Tipas can refresh my memory if we added more than that, because we wanted to work on the issue of labor as well. A lot of the work has been around the sex trafficking, but labor is definitely becoming more and more we're becoming more aware, and we wanted to make sure that those were not falling through the cracks. We contemplated adding someone from the Department of Transportation, because we have a lot of trafficking through our ports, and we wanted any insight, you know, the airport could provide, you know, the ports, and if we were missing something. However, you know, you don't want it to get too top heavy, and it is quite a large council as it is. As far as having business organizations and chamber, there is room for, you know, some public members. And right now we have, I think the organization that provides direct services to the homeless, I believe that might be My House. You know, we do ask for participation, and part of coordinating the data is working with these organizations who are doing the work. And If I recall, I think there's been some effort with some of the hotel industry to be able to offer training and really commend them for training their employees on how to spot trafficking. So just because they're not listed as a member doesn't mean that the council has not worked with different industries who would interface with persons who are trafficked.
Thank you.
Any more questions from committee members? Hearing none, Representative Vance, thank you so much for bringing this important issue forward. Today we will now set House Bill 118 aside and bring it up for public testimony and further consideration on Friday, March 21st. Thank you both for presenting the bill. That concludes today's business before the House Judiciary Committee. Before we adjourn, here is a preview of our next meetings. Friday, March 21, House Bill 74, Counterfeit Non-Functioning Airbags, will be taking up amendments. And House Bill 118, Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, public testimony. The time is now 2:28 p.m. And this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.